The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This evening I want to continue on the series of I'm doing now on emotions. And perhaps the title of the series could be called Respecting Emotions, because one of the things that I would like to convey in this series is the value of looking again, looking more deeply at our emotional life. And since the word respect in Latin means to look again, the idea of respecting also implies some deeper appreciation. Also, respect is something that we give to things which are powerful and maybe even a little bit dangerous. And so emotions can be quite powerful and also dangerous, and they warrant some respect because of that power. But to look again, to look more deeply. And so when different emotions arise, what we do in mindfulness practice is we respect them. We don't want to deny anything. We don't want to push it away. We don't want to necessarily act on it, let it take over. But we want to look carefully. It's going to just be present. Learn how to be present for it in a wise, careful way and really see what it is. And this is not just a Buddhist practice. It's something I think that many people, traditions talk about. And here's a quote from a desert father, almost 2,000 years ago. The desert father, Evagrius Ponticus. He said, "We need to reclaim anger for its proper purpose. It is always a waste of good anger to get annoyed with other human beings. What the ascetic needs to do is to focus his attention on the fact that he is annoyed. Instead of seeing some other human being angrily, he tries to see his own anger. He can then begin to fight against it." So I don't know if we need to fight against anger, but certainly there are times when anger can be quite strong in us, and we need a lot of strength, inner strength, not to give into it. So if that's fighting it, maybe it's important. Sometimes it's very important not to let anger have the upper hand. But this idea of looking at it, one tries to see one's own anger. So to really look at anger carefully, what is this anger? Which is goes against the current of what anger tends to do to us. More often than not, anger gets us swept up in its current. Often we're kind of strong. Anger has something we're angry at. And so then we're concerned with that thing that we're angry at. And sometimes we can get lost in that world of thoughts and stories and ideas and feelings and impulses in relation to that thing. And self-awareness can be lost, sometimes entirely, and sometimes it's not there in a very useful way, even though we kind of know we're angry. There sometimes can be a sense of justifiable anger. And so, if it's justified, I don't have to look at it. I can just be angry and direct it wherever I want to go. Now, one of the difficulties with this topic of anger in English is that the word anger is a jack of all trades, not exactly jack of all trades, but it's a generalist word. It's a general word that covers a huge spectrum of different emotional reactions or feelings. And so it's very important to realize that, because people will have very strong opinions about what should or shouldn't happen with anger. And usually those people have strong opinions haven't actually separated out all the different things that are subsumed, all the different kinds of emotions that can be subsumed under anger. So, for example, there's if you look in the Webster Dictionary, the definition that anger gets there is very general. Anger implies emotional agitation of no specific intensity aroused by great displeasure. Great displeasure. So is that what you thought anger was? Well, Webster did it. And then here I'll give you some other definitions. Indignation implies righteous anger arise by what is considered unjust, mean, or shameful. Rage suggests violent outbursts of anger in which self-control is lost. Fury implies an overwhelming rage of a frenzied kind that borders on madness. Ire, we don't use that word so much anymore, suggests a show of great anger in acts, words, and looks. Wrath implies deep indignation expressing itself in a desire to punish or get revenge. Hate, to have strong dislike or ill will for someone or something, to loathe or to despise. And then there's other great words like annoyed, irked, vexed, irritated. Is sulking a kind of child of anger in that category? Nowadays, people like to use the expression passive-aggressive to describe some people. And that usually kind of fits under that general category of anger. Grumpy, grouchy, resentful. And then finally, aversive. To be aversive, to have aversions often kind of... But if we take anger to be this general kind of umbrella term, then we want to be careful that we don't have some kind of deep-seated kind of manifesto belief that this is what we should do with anger. We should always express it. It's always right. We should always suppress it. It's always wrong. We have to kind of be a little more nuanced and look at what is actually, what form of anger is actually being, is happening here. Sometimes in the two words that are often translated from the Buddhist language, Pali, into English as anger is the words dosa and krodha. And both terms, as far as I can tell, have the feeling of have the aspect of hostility in it. You want to cause harm. So anger that has no hostility in it maybe wouldn't be dosa or krodha. It would be, could there be strong displeasure that has no hostility in it? Could it actually be a strong feeling of, no, this is not right. No, this is very uncomfortable. I can't go along with it. Can that be done without any hostility whatsoever? And it's interesting to, you know, if for Buddhists to go back and look at the oldest accounts we have of the Buddha himself. And there are accounts where he's talking to people where it seems that he is expressing strong displeasure. So much so, some people read and say, what's the Buddha doing being angry? I thought, you know, Buddha shouldn't be angry. Well, if anger is in this case, it includes strong displeasure with no hostility, then is it okay for the Buddha to have strong displeasure? And the way the Buddha expressed his displeasure, like to people he could, generally his own monks, but sometimes other people, was he did not seemingly did not call people good or bad or sinners, but rather he would sometimes call people foolish and a whole series of synonyms. How could you be so foolish? Now you're a really foolish person for doing that. And the idea of a fool. Now this is very interesting because calling someone foolish or pointing to the foolishness of someone in the Buddhist tradition has somewhat a comparable place as you have in the Judeo-Christian traditions of calling someone sinful. But there's a very different kind of emphasis, difference between foolishness and sinfulness. Sinfulness becomes a stain that someone has or has for a long time. Foolishness points towards a particular act, a way of being in the world, that supposedly can be changed. You can wise up. You can improve. So sometimes the Buddha spoke in strong language of his displeasure with people, and he said, "You're a foolish person." Now, I don't know if you've done that recently. I hope not. But how strong can expressions of displeasure be without there being any ill will involved? Can there be very strong movements of displeasure without any ill will? That's a very interesting question, I think. And maybe maybe we don't want to call that anger. Or maybe we think of anger as this very general term. It's very difficult to talk about anger because people have so many varied definitions. Each person has their own. So one of the problems, for example, is generally Buddhists, teachers, have been mostly talk about overcoming anger, working with it and not being caught by it when they speak English. But then some English speakers say, wait a minute, isn't there justifiable anger? Isn't there anger which is helpful and useful? And then you have to say, well, you have to look more carefully. With the Buddhist teachers, when they're talking about anger, they're in Buddhist English, they're referring to anger that has hostility in it, not other forms of strong displeasure. So are there times when it's okay to be angry or to have strong displeasure? Now, I think what we can say in Buddhism is that there's never a time for there to be hostility. Hostility is not useful. However, in the spirit of respect, when there's movements of hostility within us, then what we want to do as Buddhist practitioners is we want to look at hostility. We want to look more deeply at it. We don't want to give in to it, and hopefully it stays somewhat private, but we turn and look at it with respect. Because all of these emotions are symptoms, are signals. All of them have information in them. And if we don't stop and look at them, we can't learn what's there. So even with hostility, what is there? What's going on there that causes me to be hostile, to be angry in that kind of way? What can I learn from it? What can I learn about myself? What triggers it? About my own maybe shortcomings, where I need to work on myself. Maybe it's an indication that there's something very, really amiss in the world. The fact that I feel this hostile anger means that maybe it's not only I need to look at myself, but maybe it's something in the world that needs more careful looking at. Or maybe I need to look at both so that I can address the problem in the world without coming from a place of hostility. Because sometimes there's things in the world that can cause a strong displeasure. Something that the world, things in the world that need to be changed. But it's never useful to try to fix the things in the world through hostility. The Buddhist teaching is that hostility or hate is never overcome by hate. Hostility is never overcome by hostility. The word is dosa. Dosa is never overcome by dosa. So hostility, hate. It's only overcome by non-hate, by non-hostility. So what is it? So what does it take to come to a place where we can be motivated to act? That's an important thing, motivated to act without hostility. Now one of the descriptions in Buddhism of this word dosa, this hostility, sometimes translated as anger, is it has the quality of burning up, as explained, burning that upon which it depends. So in other words, you. So if you're angry in this hostile kind of way, it depends on you, on your energy, your effort. You're the sustenance for that fire. And that fire of anger burns you. And so there's many people have pointed out, including the Buddha, that if you want your one way that you help your enemy harm you is if you get angry with your enemy. Because then you do a harm to yourself that your enemy could never have done to you. Because you know, your enemy can't really get in there as deeply as you can get into yourself. But if you get angry on the inside, then you're causing harm to yourself. You're burning that upon which the fire depends. There's I forget his name now, but Keenan, he was an English journalist who was hostage in Lebanon in the 1970s. Is that right? And he was released after many years of being a hostage there. And someone asked him if he had any resentment for his many years, 7 years or something, in captivity. And he said, no. If I had resentment, I'd still be in prison. He was still stuck, caught. So even when there's... If we allow the word anger to be very general, to include strong displeasure, perhaps at injustice, it's interesting to look at the effect that any anger has on us, because the effect sometimes has great hooks in it, that we get pulled into the realm of that anger, that energy. And some people are very interested in, really like all the energy, the vitality of anger, because it's one way to feel alive. Or it's one way to feel kind of, you know, not just alive, but sometimes here and valid and kind of a sense of existence is really strong. Sense of purpose. Life now has a purpose. It's not no longer boring when you're angry. So some people don't have a lot of purpose in their life or a lot going on, and sometimes getting angry is a way of kind of feeling, you know, in some ways great, even though it's burning yourself, even though it has a bad feeling. It also has this kind of energy that can be very attractive. It can, for other reason as well, anger can be very captivating, and so some people will lose themselves in their anger and then do things that they wish they hadn't done. So even if it's strong displeasure, it's a justifiable reason, people sometimes will end up doing things they wish they hadn't done. They'll say things, they'll do things. Sometimes strong displeasure can shade or kind of slide into hostility very quickly. Because sometimes we don't know the difference. We haven't actually had much experience with the difference. And sometimes if we think that strong displeasure requires action, that action can be interpreted, the appropriate action can be seen as being hostility. Get rid of this, have aversion to it. I'll get out of it. Let's attack it. Let's judge it. Let's be critical in some kind of judgmental way. So what we try to do in mindfulness practice is not to be swept into the orbit of any anger whatsoever. That's not meant to say you shouldn't be angry. It's meant that you're supposed to keep your independence in relationship to it. And that can be quite tricky, depending how strong it is. So to sit back or to step back from it and say, oh, here, there's anger. Instead of saying, oh, I'm angry. To say I'm angry is innocent enough. It's not like wrong to say. If you're steaming with anger, but many times when we say I'm angry, it tends to come along with, it gets much more sticky. It tends to come along with a lot more ideas and judgment associations with what it means to be a person who's angry. But if instead of saying I am angry, you say there's anger here. There's all this anger going on. Then, in a sense, you step back from it. You're not quite entangled in it. And you have a much better chance to see it. The anger's there, and you're here. If you are angry, how are you going to be separate from it? And you say, well, I don't want to be separate. I want to be non-dual with my anger. You know, and then you punch someone out. But to kind of have the sense of independence or clarity, or about what's happening, so that the anger doesn't have the upper hand. And then to see it clearly. And then by seeing it clearly, to begin to tease apart what might be wise in it, or what might be appropriate in it, or the underlying causes and conditions for it. So, for example, many times when I've gotten angry, I try to spend time with my anger. I try to make space for it, usually privately, maybe because I'm more an introvert type, but because I think it's dangerous otherwise. And like I like if it's really strong, I like to go for a walk, and walking helps me very well to be with it. And somehow the movement of walking keeps me fluid with it. I don't get kind of bogged down in it or stuck in it. And I just hang with it, think what I'm thinking, or kind of try to understand it, until I discover the underlying condition for it, or a underlying condition for it. And for me, the two primary underlying conditions are either hurt or fear. And when I find one, and those have many different permutations, you know, so the hurt can be like pain, feeling pain, maybe frustration. When I find that one of those, then it's a whole different game. Then I can go back to the, for example, to the person I'm angry with and say, don't say I'm angry with you, which can be threatening to people, you say that. People tend to not handle very well. Most people don't handle very well the communication that says, I'm angry with you. But if you say, when you said X, I experienced all this anger inside, that gives the other person a little more chance, opportunity, not to get defensive or reactive. But if you say, when you said X, I got scared. I became afraid of our relationship. What's going to happen to it? I'm afraid, you know, of you, what you're going to say next. I'm afraid. I get afraid. Most people, my experience has been, respond very differently when you say, oh, I got afraid, versus I'm angry at you. Most people don't want you to be afraid of them. Most people will feel something's a little bit amiss here. Let's find out more. Most people don't say, great, that's what I wanted. You know, I just wanted you to show how strong, even if they did want that, some subconsciously wanted you to be afraid of them. As soon as you say you're afraid of them, it changes the whole dynamic of it all. It's like you've named it, maybe. And or if you say, I felt hurt, this becomes a different kind of conversation. So that's one thing I do, is go back and look more deeply. But then it's possible to go more deeply than that still. What is it that feels hurt, or what is it that is afraid? And there can be a lot of different things. It could be, I'm afraid of the relationship being strained, but it could also be things like, I'm afraid that my ego, my self-identity that I cherish so much, that I spent years building up and designing. I have a designer ego, somehow this beautiful self-identity that I like to use to represent myself to the world was threatened when you said X. Well, if you say that, then rather than saying, you know, when you said X, I felt fear, you said, when you said X, my self-image of myself as being a wonderfully perfect, the perfect embodiment of kindness, was threatened. Well, your friend is going to then, you know, think that's going to be very interesting. But more important, you're going to find it interesting, I hope. Oh, look at that. When I analyze it more deeply, I came that there was something I'm attached to, that I'm holding on to. And what felt threatened or hurt was some attachment, something I'm clinging to, some idea, some feeling or something. It doesn't always happen that way, but if you go deeper into yourself, sometimes you find something important that you have to understand about yourself that you couldn't understand if you didn't stop and look more deeply at the anger. I read a study some years ago, and I can't do it justice, but about they studied people who were certain kinds of people who tended to have chronic anger, a lot of anger. And they found, and they studied their speech patterns, what they tended to talk about the most. And they found that these people who are chronically angry, they tended to use the words me, myself, and mine much more often than the person in general society, the average person, the average amount of people in the society. Which then begs the question, is there a connection between a lot of self-preoccupation and anger? If you find yourself angry a lot, maybe you should look at this idea of your self-concept. Look at your speech. Look how often you think about yourself. Use the words I and me and mine. And are you constantly defending some concept of self? Are you constantly trying to project some concept of self? Are you trying to create something or have something or feel justified, feel like you deserve things? What is it? How do you carry yourself in the world? And do you carry yourself into the world in such a way that you're more likely to feel frustrated? More likely that the world doesn't accommodate. You know, the world doesn't do a great job accommodating people who are arrogant. You know, I've noticed that. You know, it's not like it seems like society is not set up really well. And so arrogant people certainly get by in life quite well sometimes. Sometimes they have good reason to be arrogant. They're really smart or something, and they get away with it. But generally, it's not a good strategy of how to get through life. And but it's a wonderful strategy for getting frustrated. So, or are there other things besides me, myself, and mine that we're holding on to and clinging, which maybe is not useful to hold on to? And you know, there's a lot of things we can point at, but that's for you. That's your job to go look more carefully. What is it? What goes on when I get angry? If I start teasing apart the different elements of anger, is there hostility in this anger? Do I wish harm on someone? Is there any kind of impulse to offend, to hurt, to get at someone, to get revenge, even mildly? Or is there not? If there's no hostility whatsoever and you're really sure of it, and it's strong displeasure, then what's the nature of that displeasure? In both situations, displeasure and hostile anger, what's really going on there? Do you have the ability to stop and use mindfulness to not get caught in the anger, but to be present for it long enough so you can kind of get to tease it apart further? Is there hurt? Is there fear that goes along with it? It doesn't always have to be hurt or fear. Sometimes it can just be very, very strong aggressive desire that can take the form of anger. I want my way, and everything else has to accommodate, or get out of my way, I'm going to, you know. And there's no hurt or fear, just a very strong personality, strong will that's very aggressive, but strong desire. And then if you look at the desire, the hurt, the fear that's underneath the anger, what is it really? What are the values, the beliefs, the desires? Is there something you're holding on to? Something you're clinging to? Is there something you're afraid of? What is it that's going on there? So the Buddhist approach is to respect these emotions, and then to use mindfulness to stop and look at it more carefully, to look at it again. And then to begin teasing apart the different elements of it and get down to deeper and deeper roots of it. And it can be quite beautiful if you go deep enough. And it seems that many times, not always, but many times, if you can keep digging, keep looking, being present and looking deeper, that underneath, at the very bottom, there might be something very beautiful. Not in the anger itself, but so, for example, there are people who might be angry, and they feel there's fear as part of that anger. And they really look at the fear, and they realize what they're afraid of is afraid of being not being safe. But underneath that is a desire for safety. There's no hostility in the desire for safety, but a desire for peace and safety. That's a reasonable feeling and motivation to have. I would say it's kind of beautiful. But then the question is, how can you best become safe? Chances are that expressions of hostility is not going to make you safe. But if you can go behind those veils to find the desire for safety, then you can say, okay, well, given that hostility is not the way, anger is not the way to become safe, are there better ways? Are there more useful ways? And there are. There are a lot of great ways to learn how to keep yourself safe. And learning how to speak wisely and usefully. Like this, there's a training called nonviolent communication. The idea behind it that there's a way of talking that doesn't express violence and it can diffuse violence as part of it. This is a little bit of a footnote or non sequitur, but I went to a family camp this weekend with my family, and you had to sign up for these different activities. And I didn't sign up for the capoeira, which was a class they had. And I just know that as a Brazilian martial art. And I thought, well, that's kind of odd for this family camp, all these little kids to have, you know, martial arts. And but I was standing nearby when they were teaching the class in the lawn, and it had morphed somehow or other by the time I got to this camp into this beautiful dance form. It was really elegant. I couldn't see the martial art in it anymore. It was a beautiful dance form. It had been disarmed. So I talked longer than I wanted to. But we have about 5 minutes if you'd like to ask any questions or make any comments. And I thought that maybe next week we continue on the topic of anger, because there's a lot to say or to explore there. But please.
What do you know of, or what did the Buddha say about stopping or resisting those who are doing harm? And I know that's a hugely arrogant thing to make the judgment that they're doing harm, but if that seems to be fairly obvious.
Yeah, so what's behind the question? Can you say a little bit more about the question?
There are some people in my life that I know I'm angry about because it affects my ego and those sort of things like that. But I think there's also another piece to that too, where I notice that they are doing harm to other members of their family and those around them in a search for safety. But at the one hand, you can appreciate safety, but if you're attempting to be safe by trying to control and gather things in such a way that you're now causing other people pain, then I'm always at how does one intervene with that or what?
Yeah, I think it's. I hope that Buddhists don't become wimps, or I hope that the practice doesn't make you so accepting of things and so relaxed that oh look at that, they're abusing each other. I'll just sit here and be non-reactive and just be mindful, and that would be horrendous. Or foolish. And I think there's a place for in English we have words like passionate action, passionate no, or In Buddhism, sometimes there's this idea of wrathful deities. And here, wrath here implies, in the dictionary, deep indignation expresses itself in the desire to punish or get revenge. In the Buddhist, in Asian Buddhist kind of mythology, these wrathful deities don't try to revenge anybody or punish anybody, but they're there to protect. And you find outside of some temples, Buddhist temples in Asia, like in Japan, places, you find sometimes these statues of the wrathful deities, you know, and they have these terrible, wrathful faces, and they look really frightening. And they're there to protect the Dharma. So the idea that you could act very strongly does exist, but in protecting something as opposed to getting what you want. So you have to look and see, you know, is it because I want, you know, what am I doing here? What's motivating me? And then to ask, what's the best motivation to come from? And a very common defense that people have for anger is that anger gets me motivated. Gets me to do things in the world. And now, if it's strong displeasure, that's fine, I guess. But I feel kind of sad if people feel anger is what's required to fight or try to stop some social injustice in the world, some injustice. Compassion is also very, very motivating. And someone can act with tremendous passion and strength and will, motivated by compassion. Compassion doesn't have to be soft and wimpy. So I think of Mahatma Gandhi. I don't think he was wrathful. You know, I don't think he was hostile towards anybody. I don't think he wanted the English hurt. If anything, he had compassion for them, but he was very dedicated. So how do you step into the fire? When you see something happening that needs to be addressed, how do we skillfully step in and say, that has to stop? And that takes a lot of skill and wisdom. But it really helps if you understand yourself. If you have the ability to stop and look and not get caught up in your reactivity and your fear and your anger and all this. If you're caught in it, you're not going to see the situation very well. And you're also less likely to act or speak in ways that are useful. So the practice is very helpful to keep us somehow calm enough so we can start seeing more carefully. Look at that situation more carefully. And then learn to find a way to talk or speak in the situation that's clear and direct. And sometimes it's a strong expression of no. No, you cannot do that. If you do that again, I'm afraid we can't be friends. You know, if you do that again, I'm afraid you cannot come to my house anymore. And I've known family members who have said that to each other. You know, that this is not acceptable. What you're doing, I can't continue this way. If you continue this way, then you can't come to my house. And I'm sorry, sister, brother, or somebody. And when you tell me you're not going to be doing this anymore, then you can come. And then sometimes we step into the fire, say something very strongly we feel needs to be said. Realizing that there are consequences. And sometimes the consequences are not good for you, in the sense that perhaps people will be angry with you for having done that. And there's not going to be much chance or ability to work it out. So that's part of the risk sometimes, is that you step into the fire and say no in a strong way or speak strongly. Doesn't necessarily mean that things get diffused. Maybe things stop, but sometimes people don't know how to handle it, or they're not very wise about it, and they can then stay angry with you. Maybe they stopped, but there is at a cost for you. So you have to kind of take all this in and then try to figure out the wisest thing to do. But to be prepared is very good. I think a prepared life is a wise life. And the story I've told a number of times here of this woman many years ago in Palo Alto came to me and said, I'm thinking about, I have to park sometimes in downtown Palo Alto at night, and I don't feel so safe, and I was thinking of buying a gun. What do you think? And I didn't want to be in a position to tell her my opinion about whether she should have a gun or not. But I said to her, I think it's a pity to buy a gun before having looked into the other alternatives. And the thing is, the other alternatives, some of them take preparation and time. You know, there's classes you can take on how to protect yourself in those kinds of situations. What's it called? Muggers. What? Bay Area? Model mugging. Model mugging. Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. But it's a kind of strange name, model mugging. How did they come up with that name? Model mugging. Oh, they model it in the class. Yeah. Oh, I see. So it's role playing. I see. Yeah. So I know people who have benefited a lot from it. They felt, and so that's a kind of preparation. So in places, in other situations where speaking is what's called for, not the. To do something like training in nonviolent communication. It takes time. But that time prepares you so that when you come in a situation, you have some skills that you can call upon to use more usefully, to practice mindfulness and meditation. So you have the ability not to get caught up in your feelings, but you can stay calm and aware of your feelings. Then you're better prepared to deal with it wisely. To wait for a crisis and then think you can figure out what to do is probably asking too much. But to prepare is a wise thing to do. Yeah?
I have a friend, a woman, who has, much to my amazement, no fear in an urban setting, no matter what. And she said she just refuses to be to circumscribe her life so that she feels like a prisoner if she wants to go someplace. She's not a mad woman here. But she said that one time, for instance, she was alone and she was walking home in a place where it's sort of early morning hours, I think. And she realized that she was in a street where there was nobody around. She realized that somebody was following her. And she tested it out long enough to be absolutely certain the man was following her. So what she did was to simply to go in huge loops down the middle of the street. There was nobody on the street. In such a way that didn't look as though she was staggering. So it wasn't a situation that could be taken advantage of. It looked completely unpredictable and weird. And he stopped following her. Just went away.
There's a lot of great stories out there of people who have done things that where they got safely out of a dangerous situation. And most of the great stories that I know of were not planned strategies. So you've been talking about fear, but rather in the moment, they thought of something, and they never could have thought of. They would have never dreamed about it before, but somehow in the situation, it seemed like the right thing to do. And I've also known people who've done the wrong thing. I know one person that I know was held up. I don't know if it was at gunpoint or knife point, but was held up. And as a consequence of the series of things that followed, he was the one who ended up in jail. Because he went home and got a gun and went after him, after the mugger. And it had a big consequence for the rest of his life. You know, he lost his job and, you know, he was the guy who was mugged, right? But because how he reacted to it, and, you know, he's still living the consequences now, 25 years later, and because of how he reacted. And then I've known people who are mugged, and this my great favorite story. It was a priest at Zen Center who was going to a meeting, And he was being mugged, and he was talking to the mugger and saying, well, you can have all my money and all that, but I do need my driver's license and stuff. And so they kind of had a deal and worked it out. and then he went into the Zen Center for his meeting. And as they were, when he was negotiating, talking, you know, with this mugger, another priest walked by. And so when they both were in the meeting, the muggee said to his friend, oh, did you notice I was talking to that guy on the sidewalk when you walked by? Oh, yeah, he was mugging me. So, oh, I had no idea. I thought you guys were just... And then another person who said, was being held up by these three young teenagers, and he just looked at them and said something, your mother would be ashamed of you. And they ran away. But what I like to believe is that the ability to be calm and present is one of the really important conditions for discovering what the right intuitive thing is in the moment. And when we lose our calm, get caught up in the drama of it all and our feelings and all, then we're more likely to act foolishly.
Actually, in the model mugging, in learning that, one of the thing that you really taught is that if you're in a situation, to get very quiet and to, instead of reacting, to get quiet and wait for your opportunity. So it's counterintuitive because you tend to be fearful and non-reactive,
right.
But you really have to practice just being quiet and that moment is there, but you have to really wait and you have to be mindful and then you can make your escape.
So we should stop. And are you guys up for another evening on anger?
Yeah.
And so next week is then Ajahn Sundara, the nun's going to come. So we'll have to wait 2 weeks to follow up on anger. I don't mean to leave you hanging in anger, but...